It's 8:13 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Summit County Council meeting tomorrow, starting early, 1:30 at the Richens Services Building. In the studio with a preview of that agenda, I have Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie.
First, a presentation by the folks, Save People, Save Wildlife here. The folks working to build wildlife fences along the Interstate 80 corridor. Just a brief report here.
Yeah, they were in a few weeks ago to offer some public comment, and the council asked them to come back and give a little bit broader view and public vetting, or not vetting, but public view of what they're up to and what has transpired since that public comment, which it looks like UDOT's positively working on some wildlife fencing.
So do they have any requests for the county?
Not that I know of specifically. However, they have been required, UDOT has offered to put in about a $100,000 project. They're going to split that cost with the group. The group has formed a 501(c). So I know that they're out there raising money.
All right. Then at 2:30, a discussion with regard to the fairgrounds master plan here. The council is being presented with the preferred alternative for the fairgrounds master plan, which then they will be voting on later this month on the 26th. So the preferred option shows development on both sides of Chalk Creek with a upgraded pedestrian bridge connecting them. So talk about some of the new features there.
Sure. It goes back to the beginning of the year, end of last year, when the council finally made the decision to not buy a new piece of property, but to expand the property that we had. That kind of sent us into a new phase of master planning, so that with the idea that we wanted to redevelop the property that has aged well, but it needs some updating in a way that could accommodate the fair, but could also provide a good amenity to the North Summit area. We've got an old building there called the Quonset Hut that serves as a community building. Certainly has been around, I hear different stories, at least since the 1940s, 1950s, has had a useful life and probably needs to be replaced. We could reconfigure some athletic fields that exist there, and eventually we're going to have to replace the rodeo grounds as they age out as well. So a lot of reconfiguration of the property providing some new amenities as well.
All right. So we're going to build a new multi-purpose building that replaces the Quonset Hut?
That's the proposal. It would be a large floor area building that could have some offices in it as well as some small meeting space that could accommodate everything from, of course, for the fair, some of the home arts and the art exhibits that we do. It will have a commercial kitchen that will allow some of the food preparation that would go on. But it could also be rented out by the community for different large events.
And then also a new building for the livestock and animals, all that stuff comes down?
Yeah. The buildings that we currently do the livestock showing for the 4-H portion of the fair have a lot of age to them. Haven't had a lot of have a lot of deferred maintenance at this point, so probably would look at building new structures, whether they were buildings or whether they're covered areas that would allow that thing to happen during the fair, but also could have some multiple use in different parts of the year.
So is the space going to be different for where we put the county rides and the vendors, or does that just remain a grassy space?
It could be. I mean, it could be reconfigured to flow a little bit better. Right now we're kind of between the rodeo grounds and a softball field. We'd like to open up that space a little bit more and provide a little bit more open space in that part of the property, what would be behind a new community building, in order to accommodate that part of the fair.
So you're looking at a phased build-out?
Absolutely. I mean, the price tag on this master plan, just in estimates, would be somewhere between the $8 and $12 million mark, as according to the literature that I read. We don't have that kind of money to dedicate towards this right up front. So, a master plan is a future vision for a property, and we would not plan on doing that all at once.
So how much do we have to spend?
I meant to have that number when I came in this morning. The number I've gotten from my staff in the last day is around $6 to $6.5 million. But I'm not going to want to be quoted on that because I need to make sure.
And is that to pay for the property, or already have another fund for that?
What that is, I mean, we've already purchased the property, so those expenditures have already been made. This is what's in fund balance under the transit room tax revenue line. So I just need to confirm that that's the number.
Yeah. So how much do you get every year? Do you have any idea?
Well, approximately, the collections on TRT run somewhere between $7.5 and $8 million in the last year. So the county retains 10% of that for this type of project or these types of projects. So the county increases their fund balance if we don't spend it by about $700,000 to $800,000 a year.
Okay. So besides the multi-purpose building there that you're planning, I mean, what else would go here to make that location usable year-round?
Absolutely. So we're working closely with Colville City and the North Summit Recreation District to help us make those decisions. Some of the desires of those two groups, they would like things that could support their rec programs. So a large field space that could accommodate or be striped for a soccer field, a lacrosse field, football, any type of youth or adult recreation like that. Softball field, as they already have on the property, as well as we've talked about perhaps a splash pad in the future. Or even better playground space that we have playground space now, but it's not adequate, and we'd like to improve that.
All right. Later on in the afternoon, a discussion and possible approval of an ordinance to approve the master development agreement for the Deer Meadows subdivision in Tollgate Canyon. This is one that has been pending for years. So will this finally finish off with it?
Well, my understanding is that, especially one of the big issues, which was, the extinguishing of the development rights on other property in order to establish these was one of the issues of the council, and they wanted that written into the development agreement around the plat more explicitly before they adopted that. I believe staff has worked through that, and that will be in the document that the council is reviewing.
All right, so it's calling for 7 units spread over nearly 100 acres, 1 unit already built, the so-called Uncle Tom's Canyon. So the project not decreasing density.
It is not decreasing density, but it's also not increasing density because they would have to extinguish development rights that are equal to that in order to bring those online.
Okay. Will public input be allowed tomorrow?
Yes, this will be a public hearing, as I understand. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Conduct a public hearing, and then the staff is recommending approval.
All right. A big issue, and we've seen a lot of media about this, is the appeal over the grading permit for hole 11 at the Canyons Golf Course. The complaint in a nutshell is that the work has been not just for berm, but a detention structure as well, so that it needs a development permit, not just a grading permit, which the project received. The appellants also say that the berm is higher than allowed by code. So what's the staff's response to that?
So, the staff's response is, at this point, is that the development the grading permit does allow everything that is being done on the property and has been applied for appropriately and is being followed appropriately. I certainly understand the concerns. I've seen the pictures, just as everybody else has, of what it looks like to a few of the property owners, and certainly I understand their concern with that. They have every right to file appeal, and I think if I were in their position, I would too. and see if this is the right way to do this.
So they're calling it a dirt dump. I mean, that's what it certainly looks like. I mean, when we think about grading, you think about just pushing dirt around. I mean, there was dirt brought here and, I mean, a wall built.
And my understanding at this point, and of course I have not heard all of or read through all of the materials either, and we'll hear about that at the council meeting tomorrow, is that the grading that was done is according to the development agreement. So, you know, until we hear that in front of council, that's the staff's position.
All right. And then, again, the council hears the appeal, makes a decision, and then if the appellants don't like it, then it's an issue that is taken to court?
Yeah, I imagine there's due process beyond the council if that's the case. We've had several grading permits that have come to task in the last couple of years, and that's usually the next step if the appellants don't like the answer that they receive.
All right. Finally, you're holding an open house elsewhere in the Richens building for two proposed transit taxes, each a quarter of 1%. So that's 1 cent for every $4 spent. One fund to be used for transit services, the other for capital projects. So where's room 133?
133 is in the basement or the lower level of the Richens building next to the DMV, if people are familiar with where that's at. And the reason we're doing this is just to provide another opportunity as people, if they want to come and make public comment on the two propositions to the council, they have another forum ahead of that public comment session in order to ask questions of staff, clarify anything that they need clarification of before they enter that the public comment session.
Okay, and you will be displaying the possible priority projects?
Yeah, I mean the priority projects have not changed since the council contemplated those. First of all, the joint councils contemplated those during the summer and before the council put the two propositions on the ballot in August. So everything is exactly the same as it has been the whole time. We just want to provide as much information as possible out there. So if people want to have any questions that they need to ask, come and ask those questions before the hearing, before the public comment period.
So what's the purpose of public input? I mean, the proposals are already on the ballot.
Absolutely. Know? I think it's simply, well, first of all, it's state law that we have to do it. We're required to do one. We're doing two so that we cover both sides of the county appropriately. And then it's just another opportunity to vet issues that might be out there and to provide a public forum for those that might be positive to the propositions or negative.
Yeah. Have you heard any people coming out against this?
We have not. We have not heard anything negative at this point.
Okay. Tom, anything else you wanted to mention?
Also the Project for Deeper Understanding, same issues with the propositions and the transportation projects that are upcoming 7 p.m. on Thursday at the St. Luke's Church. RAP tax grant applications are out.
All right, Tom, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Park City Planning Commission once again reviewing the Treasurer conditional use permit application in the studio with a preview of the topics. The Planning Commission will review at its meeting tomorrow night. Planning Director Bruce Erickson. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Leslie.
Meeting starts at 5:30 once again at Jim Santee Auditorium.
Once again, we're setting record crowds. It'll be at the Jim Santee Auditorium, 5:30.
All right. Staff report says the Planning Commission will look at three criteria. Number 8, building mass, bulk, and orientation on site. Number 11, the design compatibility with surrounding buildings. And number 15, the impacts on environmentally sensitive land, slope, and topography. The report also outlines the format the planning staff has planned for the next three meetings. So can you go through what those are?
Sure. So we're moving on to the next set of criteria. After the UE discussions, I think everybody's, all the planning commissioners have kind of gotten ready to make a determination on that, and they'll make a determination on UEs at the end of the meeting. So we're moving on to these next three criteria, which the best way to deal with them is you look at them together. Planner Astorga has done a really nice job of building the exhibits, demonstrating the difference between the originally approved Woodruff drawings and the MPD and the new current plans for excavation. So we're not going to focus on the architecture at this point. It's more about how big the blobs are and what the size of the excavation is and how the mitigation plan works for that.
Is that a 3D model that we're
The applicant will bring a SketchUp model, which is a computer model, and we'll be able to look at it from different directions. We'll do that in the meeting coming up Wednesday night, and then we will have a work session on, in November 9th, I believe, at which point we'll continue to discuss with the applicant how that mass Balkan scale fits on the site, and then we'll conduct a public hearing. So the public is invited to the work session. They'll be able to make comments, and then in December, I think we're going to wrap up this portion of the discussion. The most important points are similar to the UE conversation, the unit equivalent conversation, in that planning staff has done their calculations of excavation, and the applicant has done their calculations. And there's some discrepancies between what Woodruff would have allowed, what the applicant is proposing, which is on the order of 700 to 900,000 cubic yards, and the staff calculation, which is in that same range of 700 to 900,000 cubic yards for the current proposal.
So in all three of these criteria, the staff have concerns, reaffirming basically former planner Katie Catan's conclusions that she made back in 2009. So nothing has really changed for
Nothing has really changed. We're drilling down more into the details, and we're also taking a look at the applicant proposed mitigation. This is a conditional use permit, so a lot of the determination the Planning Commission has to make is whether the mitigation is adequate, will it work, who takes care of it in the future. So that's what we're looking at, especially on these large-scale excavations, which are going to be in the northwest corner, could be as much as 120 to 140 feet deep, several hundred feet back from the road.
So let's talk a little bit about that. When you talk about 700 to 900 cubic yards, I mean, I don't know how we figured
thousand,
that in our
thousand
head.
Cubic yards, 700,000 cubic yards.
How many trucks loads?
A truck is good for about 10 cubic yards.
So do the math for me.
No, I'm not going to do the math for you. Thank you. The applicant has proposed a conveyor system where they would put the material on a conveyor and run it up the hill into some of the locations on the ski runs. They've provided locations for approximately 300,000 yards in Creole Gulch, and then they have some suggested locations for the remaining 600,000, one of which would take all the trees off the top of the hill at the top of Payday Lift and put several hundred thousand yards of material up there. So the staff has some serious concerns about that. Going forward in the meeting in December, we're going to be taking a look at management of potential blasting activities to do that excavation. The applicant has submitted a plan for blasting, and we're not comfortable with that plan yet at this point either.
So we're excavating to create more room, more
right,
space?
Right. What in effect they're doing is they're creating a platform and then building the buildings up to the existing grade height. And you'll see that in the exhibits that Francisco has prepared. So instead of stepping the buildings with the site, they've come up with this concept called cliffscape. And what they do is excavate back into the hill, create a gunite wall and make it look like cliffs, and then build the buildings on a relatively flat platform.
That makes it easier to do the actual construction as opposed to building up the hill?
No, what it does is allow them to build these buildings up to the height that was allowed. So if they were on existing grade or stepping with the grade, they'd never be within the height restrictions.
Okay.
So all of the calculations are from existing grade. So if they dig down, existing grade remains the same, and that enables them to build taller buildings.
All right, but it also means retaining walls, too.
A significant retaining wall.
And we've kind of been through that lesson, haven't we, with Ella's claim in terms of what is allowed with a retaining wall?
Yes. And because they're, all of the retaining wall that they're going to do is going to have to be reviewed under the Historic District Guidelines, which is the requirement of the MPD. So we're not sure that the cliffscape is approvable. We're not sure of the retaining walls that would be along Empire and Lowell Avenue. So there's a lot of things to go on after we get through these next three meetings.
And that's why you talk about kind of the future and who's responsible.
Right.
When you start talking about retaining walls that eventually,
yep.
The force of nature.
Yes. Force of nature, safety concerns, wildlife concerns, visual compatibility concerns, the effect on the hillside. Like I say, the exhibits are pretty self-explanatory. I'm pretty happy with Francisco's work on this one.
Okay. So the applicant is proposing to alter the grade beyond the original master plan by how much?
That's an interesting question. It appears that the excavations in Woodruff were not completely fleshed out, so we don't know exactly how far in the ground they were going. They certainly weren't going several hundred feet.
With regard to criteria number 11, the staff report mentions some very specific buildings with massing concerns and how they're visible from Main Street, Heber Avenue, Lowell, and Empire, the surrounding neighborhood. If this is all about mitigating the impact, then how does the applicant do that?
That is the applicant's job, is to attempt to mitigate that mass, bulk, and scale. I think once we get the big blocks organized to kind of replicate or mimic what Main Street looks like, then we'll start dealing with the architectural details.
Still, the approval back in 1986 did approve a master plan, and we knew that there was going to be more height and density than the neighboring Old Town buildings.
Yes. One of the key components is that the current plan rotated the buildings from stepping more up the hill to a more horizontal layout where they tend to go back into the hill and move sideways, so the mass of the building appears larger.
Okay. Let's see. Concerning mine waste, back in 2009, the city's environmental coordinator did not agree with the project's environmental proposal. Has that changed at all?
We haven't gone down any further into that one, so I don't know the answer for right now, whether that mine waste is hazardous or not. We're assuming that there's something in it, but we don't know how much.
All right. The report also notes that Treasurer's CUP, conditional use permit application, has increased from 849,000 square feet in 2004 to more than 1 million square feet in 2008. So what we're trying to figure out is that justified?
What we're trying to find out is if that can be mitigated as well as justified. They have two main sets of things to do. One is we need to make a determination that it's in compliance with the original approved master plan in 86, and that it meets all 15 criteria and that the mitigation is appropriate and will be successful.
So what's your response to the applicants who contend that at the last hearing they were encouraged and guided by the planning staff some 10 years ago, and then staff, the Katie Kattan report as it's known, changed positions with no explanation about that?
I can't comment on that directly because I wasn't there, but we know generally that folks tend to hear what they want to hear. And unless the Planning Commission has taken action, there is no direction and guidance from the staff. All we can do is line out the criteria and give an explanation of why things need to happen.
Okay. In addition to Treasurer, busy working on with the helicopter proposal, where do things stand there?
Well, there's a couple things coming forward that the public will want to know about. We're talking about updating our helicopter definitions to match the county, and that'll be happening in December. Moving backwards, we have a tentative meeting right now for November 30th, at which Community Development Director Ann Laurent will be bringing forward changes to the Land Management Code for lighting, energy use, and transportation, making sure that we have all of the transportation stuff that's coming out of Alfred Knott's in our Land Management Code. Transportation demand management, parking restrictions, all of those things need to go into the LMC. So we'll be having a hard discussion on November 30 about that. We were tentatively going to bring forward the discussion of xeriscaping and gravel on the 26th of October, but I think that's going to get pushed to either November 9th or November 30th.
All right. Let's talk really briefly about that. People were allowed to park their RVs in their front yards through the end of the month.
That's correct.
Then they must be moved.
That's correct.
And then something will happen, do you think, over the winter?
Over the winter something is going to happen. We're bringing forward some regulations on how to make that happen. We've drilled into the previous ordinances to see what's changed. We're going to rely on the folks to meet their commitment that said by about November 1st they're in the storage yards in Heber or Oakley or wherever they want to take them.
Yeah. Where did you anticipate, though, the new ordinance coming down, allowing some temporary summer parking?
Yes, I think we'll allow some temporary summer parking. I think we need to make sure that access to the garage is maintained. I think we need to make sure that two cars of parking are maintained. And one of the things that we're learning during the wildland fire urban interface is one of the reasons for side yard setbacks to be open is to have the firefighters get access to the back of your building or to your neighbor's building. So if you've got a 40-foot RV taking up all of your side yard, firefighters not getting to your backyard, and they may not be getting to the neighbors. So there's a firefighting consideration in the side yard discussion as well.
Okay. Bruce, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Leslie.
Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, coming up tomorrow for the PC Marks Free Lunchtime Learning, we're talking about physical therapy and the pelvic floor. In the studio with me, Dondi Shearer-Leist, to tell us about that, along with this month's guest, Kathy Bochnowski. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Dondi, want to give us the introduction?
Yeah, so I'm here to invite the community to our free lunchtime learning tomorrow from 12 to 1 p.m. at the PC Mark in Park Meadows. And to introduce our guest speaker, Kathy, we're really excited. This is like the first time we've had this topic for our lunchtime learning. And I'm really hoping that we have a good turnout tomorrow.
Okay, so what are you going to be talking about, Kathy?
Well, thank you for having me. I want to be talking specifically about the role of the physical therapist and how, as my specialty, we help women who have pelvic floor dysfunction. And so the big question that I hear from people is, what is the pelvic floor? And, you know, what can go wrong with it? And what is normal and acceptable? And when do we need to go and seek more medical help?
Okay. And what can physical therapists do about it? And we're talking about basically women bearing children, right? And some of the pressure that's put on that? Or is that just a natural gravity that...
It is a natural gravity that happens over time. I treat women from ages 18 all the way up into their 80s. So this can be a problem that occurs prior to having any children, but certainly having children can make problems become worse.
Okay, so what can you do about it?
So as a physical therapist, the main thing that I feel that I do is educate my patients on how to use their body properly so that they don't create more problems for themselves, and also how to avoid certain habits that can be further damaging to their pelvic floors. So the number one question that I get when a patient comes in is, you know, my doctor told me that I should be working on strengthening my pelvic floor and doing these Kegel exercises. I think I'm doing them right, but how do I know for sure if I am? And even if I am, they're not helping me. And so one of the main things that I do is teach people how to properly contract their pelvic floor so that they're tightening everything that needs to be tight, lifting the things that need to be lifted, and certainly not doing it the opposite way, which would be bearing down and creating more problems.
So in terms of actually improving the situation, I mean, how often do exercises like this have to be done?
Well, we start off and I ask people to do their exercises. If this is the prescription, I treat all sorts of different issues as well. But if we're speaking specifically about urinary incontinence, I start them off, I want them to do their exercises about twice a day, anywhere from 50 to 80 contractions per day. And then when they finally hit that point where they're happy, they're no longer having any leakage when they work out hard, or, you know, they can make it to the bathroom without having that sudden urge. And they can delay an urge, for instance, rather than having to feel they have to run to the bathroom every 15 to 30 minutes, they can delay it and have a better quality of life. Then I reduce it and I say, now you're on a maintenance program. Do it two or three times a week and just incorporate these exercises, doing them the right way with everything that you do in your normal life.
So at what point is surgery required?
Great question. So I'm a huge believer in physical therapy first and after surgery. In the instance that a patient has really given it an honest effort and they have not improved with their symptoms, that's when it's time to go and seek surgical consultation, specifically with prolapse issues, which is where you have one of your pelvic organs that's slowly kind of descending downward and not in the right position anymore. Surgery can certainly be helpful, but if you have surgery and you haven't learned how to avoid doing the wrong things and how to make sure you're doing the right things, chances are within 5 years you're going to end up having problems coming back.
Okay. Again, noon to 1 o'clock tomorrow at the party room at the PC Mart.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Leslie.
Okay. Thank you. Well, for parents wondering what kinds of special services can help if their kindergarten through 12th grade child may be struggling in school, they may want to plan to attend Thursday's roundtable. In the studio with details, I have parents Shauna Wiest along with Natalie Heron. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning,
Leslie. Good morning.
So the event's being put on by Connect Summit County. This is an organization that was formed earlier this year to destigmatize mental illness. It's taking place 6:30 to 8:30 at the Park City Community Church. You're going to be specifically discussing the accommodation programs available for children grades K through 12 with mental health issues as well as some other needs. So when we talk about mental illness, I mean, I think mostly depression, but I mean, what are we talking about? What does this encompass?
Well, when we're talking...
I should say, this is Shauna speaking.
Yes. Yeah. Well, when we're talking about mental illness, it could be anything such as major depression, bipolar disorder, psychosis, which has a very large spectrum, or it could be a neurological disorder. And the IEPs and Section 504 plans we're going to talk about also cover physical disorders such as autism, dyslexia, diabetes, other physical impairments.
So when we talk about who should attend, it's probably mostly people with other health issues as opposed to just some kind of mental illness issue.
Well, yes, but the problem is that a lot of parents may not know that these services are available for their children. My experience was that my son was very sick for 7 months in the hospital, and the doctors and the school the hospital teacher actually notified me that I would be that this IEP would be available to me, and they actually physically came with me to the school to have this program implemented. But my fear is that parents that don't have this kind of advocacy, we want to have this class to create more transparency and to ease the burden and struggle of them.
Okay. And Natalie, you also had some experience dealing with one of these programs, yeah?
I did not, and that is part of the reason why I'm here. I have a daughter who has gone through the school district, through the school system. She actually graduated from the Park City Learning Center. And her issues with deep depression began her sophomore year. We did not move to the Learning Center until mid-junior year, and the services that may or may not have been available for her, I was not even informed about. So instead of looking back and seeing what could have been, should have been, my goal is to inform the community that these services are available. And let's ask the questions. Let's get it on the table. Let's get a big group to this parent workshop on Thursday evening. And anyone who has a child that is struggling with something that is interfering with their learning should be present at this workshop.
All right. You're going to have two experts come from the Utah Parents Center to attend this. And we're talking about two federal programs. One, as you mentioned, the IEP, that's Individualized Education Plan, and then a Section 504. Can you briefly describe the differences?
Yes. The 504 is more of an accommodation program for a child that has a disability. And again, it could be a physical disability or a mental health disability. And the IEP is more of a formalized, structured plan that also contains a 504. It's very convoluted and not always transparent. And that's why we're encouraging parents to come on Thursday night so they can learn more about these programs.
So these aren't easy, though, to get access into, are they?
Well, actually, they are. Every school has to have a special education administrator that refers children. If they suspect that any child may have a disability, whether a physical or mental health impairment, they're required by law to identify those children and at least provide an assessment to them to see if they are eligible for these programs.
So it just seems to me what I have heard about getting your child into one of these programs, it's just a lot of red tape.
It is. And like I said, in my experience, I was fortunate to have a physician and a hospital teacher to advocate for me along the way, because I cannot underscore enough that when you have a child that's very ill, that's what you're focusing on. You're not necessarily focusing on the education piece, and you really need a liaison at the school to help you.
All right. So this Connects Parent Roundtable, this is a new group. Tell me more about this.
So the roundtable is part of Connect, and what our goal is to partner and to create a team between the parents and the students that are struggling and the school district. And as Shauna said, the law states that there needs to be something in place. And it does say the school district must have a procedure for finding children that have disabilities. And that parent or that personnel can refer the child to be evaluated. Now, the evaluation doesn't always lead to an IEP or a 504. But how do you know if your child's eligible? And that is where the information gap, I feel, has been. We haven't been completely informed that these programs are available and how to find out if your child is eligible and get through the red tape to get that plan in writing and in place. So there is a team working together. That is what the parents working group is trying to accomplish.
Great. Parents will also be able to meet Jennifer Slade. She'll be there. She's the new director of special ed at Park City School District. And how can she help?
Well, she's going to provide the local perspective. So the experts from the Utah Parent Center will actually break down what the IEP in 504 is, what the process for obtaining one is, and if you disagree with the school or need to appeal, what that process is. And so we're so fortunate to have Jennifer Slade come and actually offer the local perspective for parents of what the next steps will be.
Okay. You're saying this is going to be offered in both English and Spanish at the same time, or are you going to break the groups out?
They are offered at the same time in two different rooms at the Park City Community Church. The presentation will be held in both languages. We are hoping to get a big crowd there. It will explain the difference between the IEP and the Section 504 plans. And we are also going to be inviting other parents who might want to be part of the parent working group. We will have information about that. We'd love to expand our knowledge and get more parents involved. That meeting will be happening on the 18th of October, and we will have the opportunity to explain more about that also Thursday night.
Okay, Natalie and Shauna, thanks for coming in this morning. Well, Halloween's coming, and the Run Revolution Foundation celebrating a bit early. In the studio with details, I have the executive director of the One Revolution Foundation, Benita Hutchison. Good morning, Benita.
Good morning.
So you started this, I know, last year. I don't know how many years it's been running, but it's the Halloween Bash.
Yes, last year. This weekend, the 15th, Saturday night from 7 to midnight at OP Rockwell. We're so excited. It's such a fun event.
Okay.
We just love it.
What happens?
We have an 80s band this year, the Breakfast Club, so we're going to rock it out 80s style. Never been to an 80s party and left saying that was no fun. Always a blast. We have a silent auction. Just some, you know, some great people really celebrating our mission here in Park City.
Okay. Tickets include what?
Tickets, they're $75 and include two drinks, the band, the food is provided by Stein. It's going to be excellent. They're great sponsors of ours, so we're happy to have them this year.
Okay. There is a costume contest, but costumes are optional.
Yep.
Was there a prize for the winner?
The couple of cocktails and a fabulous trophy.
Okay. So Chris Waddell, of course, is the founder of One Revolution, and he's out on the road.
He is. He's in the New England area this week, living out our mission. He's giving name tags programs across the country, which is our education program. We serve about 75,000 students across the country, teaching them it's not what happens to you, it's what you do with what happens to you, a resilience-based education program.
Okay. So this is basically a fundraiser for the work that you guys are doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. 100% of the proceeds benefit the program.
Okay. What else does One Revolution do besides the name tag program?
You know, name tags right now is our biggest program. We're really working to grow that program. In addition, we fund upside down grants, which are short films that turn perception of disability upside down. We fund 5 films every year. Those have been really wildly successful. The stories are just incredible. And then we're also doing storytelling clinics and teaching people with disabilities how to tell their story in a way that really changes the way people see them. It's all about not that I broke my back in a ski accident, but I am a biker, I am a skier, telling them what you do and who you are and not what happened to you.
All right. Well, speaking of athleticism, Chris just finished the Chicago Marathon and now is working towards the Boston Marathon.
Yeah. I mean, the guy just never stops. He amazes me every day. We took a group of donors to Iceland and they raised money and ran the Reykjavik Marathon. And he has not stopped training since. That was in August. Went on to do Chicago, qualified for Boston. So you will see him, I'm sure, biking around town all winter this year.
Yeah. So it's 26 mile. I mean, is it a? It's a in his hand cycle, but.
Yeah, you know, it's not the hand cycle that is the pedals. It's a racing chair specifically designed for racing, and you essentially punch the wheels down, and it is this traditional marathon. And he finished the Chicago Marathon in under 2 hours. It's so fast. The world record for a marathon in a wheelchair is 1 hour 18 minutes, which is like time to go shower and have a cup of coffee. And then come back and watch the runners finish.
In terms of getting tickets for Saturday night, how do people do that? Just at the door?
You can buy them at the door. You can also purchase them in advance on our website at one-revolution.org, and you just click right on the Halloween button.
Okay. Good luck, Shauna. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
That's